There's a long list of women for whom this book meant very specific freedom and ambition, and what I wanted to do was make a film that was in the tradition of why that inspired them.
Filmmaker Greta Gerwig's adaptation of Little Women celebrates the classic novel's theme of women charting their own lives. Plus, Jonathan Pryce is not the pontiff, but he plays one in The Two Popes.
When I was first asked to play Pope Francis, I thought, oh no, this isn't a good idea. Because the day he'd become Pope, the internet was full of images of me next to him. One of my sons sent me a text saying, Dad, are you the Pope?
And a photographer turns objects confiscated at the border into art. It's the Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later today, for 15 years, Franklin Leonard has tracked the most liked screenplays in Hollywood. This year's list is out now. But we'll start with a new film that opens Christmas Day. It's an adaptation of the Louisa May Alcott novel Little Women, and it is a lovely little gift of a movie.
You mind yourself, dearie. Someday you'll need me, and you'll wish you had behaved better.
Thank you, Aunt March, for your employment and your many kindnesses, but I intend to make my own way in the world.
Oh, well, no one makes their own way. Not really. Least of all a woman. You'll need to marry well.
But you are not married, Aunt March.
Well, that's because I'm rich.
The film is from writer-director Greta Gerwig. It stars Saoirse Ronan. She played the lead in Greta's directorial debut, Lady Bird. And the rest of the March sisters are played by Emma Watson, Eliza Scanlon, and Florence Pugh. Laura Dern plays their mom, and Meryl Streep is their wealthy Aunt March. Gerwig has been thinking about Little Women for a very long time, well before she even found out that producer Amy Pascal was developing a new adaptation of the novel. Here's Greta Gerwig.
Little Women has been a book that I have loved my whole life in a very deep way, to the point where my memories and the memories of the March sisters were intertwined in that way that I think books of your youth can mean something even beyond being books, because they become part of your family. I think that's the magic of reading when you're a child, is that the distinction between fiction and reality is thin for you, or it was for me anyway. But I hadn't read it since I was about 14 or 15, and then I read it in my early 30s, I think when I turned 30. And I all this stuff came out at me in the book that it had not when I was a child.
When I get in a passion, I get so savage, I could hurt anyone, and I'd enjoy it.
You remind me of myself.
But you're never angry.
I'm angry nearly every day of my life.
Reading it as an adult, I heard all of these different things. I saw it as much spikier and sadder and stranger and almost more triumphant in a certain way, and also just this kind of being aware of an author was another layer of it for me, that Joe both wants to be an author, but then Louisa as author. And so even though Joe March, by the end of the book, says she stops up her ink well and stops writing and, you know, gets married and has children and opens a school, that Louisa, though, wrote, and she wrote that book, and we know it because there's the book. You know, I just sort of had an idle thought about, well, if I made this, I'd want to center on this. I'd want to center on all these themes that I felt I hadn't really seen yet about it, which was ambition and money and women and art. And I heard in passing, my agent said at a dinner, oh, they're interested in making Little Women again. And I was like, wait, what? I have to go talk to them. I have an idea. And I hadn't made anything at that point, but he got me a meeting, and I went and I talked to them, and I told them some version of what I wanted to do. And I said, I want to direct it. And I want to write in. I want to direct it. And I had nothing to really show that I could do that. So, but they very luckily hired me to write it. And then I wrote my draft in 2015, 2016. And then I went away and I made Lady Bird. And then by the time I was finishing that up, they said, well, what do you think about making Little Women? And I said, well, I knew you'd ask. I'm ready. but it was one of those fortuitous turns of events.
I want to ask about that perspective that you had of reading the book as an adult versus as a young woman.
Sure.
And the perspective you have as somebody who is a creative person,
yes,
writing movies and
yes,
making movies.
Yes.
Because so much of the movie, and it's certainly in the book as well, is about the challenges of being a creative person and how you value your own art, how you compromise with the people who are financing it, and how you find your voice even in those parameters.
That's right. No, there's a you picked up all the cards I put down. No, it's funny. It's that the opening scene between Jo March and her publisher, Mr. Dashwood, which the majority of it is actually word for word from the book, when she says, I took care to have a few of my sinners repent. And he says, people want to be amused, not preached at. Morals don't sell nowadays. That could be me talking to a studio head about something I want to do. It was all there for me to be discovered. I didn't invent it. Like I said, that scene is a scene from the book. But it felt just so relevant to right now. And then beyond that, when I was researching Louisa May Alcott, and it became clear that who Louisa May Alcott was equally the subject that I was interested in. And then when you learn about her life is, you know, unlike Jo, she never got married, she never had children, but she kept writing. And she did keep her copyright of Little Women, which is a huge thing that she did. And I mean, there were so many things about her life and what she did that felt eerily familiar. And I think even in the fact that her publisher and even herself, but her publisher truly didn't know what a hit he had. And I find that happens all the time, that there's a constant underestimating of audiences that are not the same audience of the people who are in charge of publishing or whatever that may be.
The first half of Little Women,
yes,
because
yes,
it is really two books as written, ends so grouped, the curtain falls upon Meg, Jo, Beth, and Amy. Whether it ever rises again depends upon the reception given to the first act of the domestic drama called Little Women.
Yes.
It's almost like she's saying, I've got a sequel, but I hope people buy the first
That's
version.
Right. No, she's a business lady. No, she it's worth saying, the initial printing sold out in 2 weeks, and it has not been out of print for 150 years.
In 1984, there was a story, Little Women leads poll, novel rated ahead of Bible for influence on high school pupils.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice. I mean, it's just nice for her.
It's great for her. And it raises this other question of like what people take away from the book, because you can interpret it in very different ways. And I'm going to give you two prominent women who have thoughts about it. The first is Gloria Steinem, who said in 1992, where else could we have read about an all-female group who discussed work, art, and all the great questions, or found girls who wanted to be women and not vice versa?
Oh, that's beautiful. Found girls that wanted to be women. That's
and
nice.
Not vice versa. And here's the author, Camille Paglia, who says, the whole thing is like a horror movie to me.
I know. I think if you have an idea in your head of the iconography of Little Women, it's usually from the first book. It's the kind of Christmas to Christmas structure. And the second half of the book, Louisa May Alcott joked she should have called the wedding marches because they all got married. And truly,
the British version is called Good Wives.
Exactly. So, you know, it was in this two book structure, which is part of why I structured the film as I did, starting with them as adults, because I wanted to start with the second half. But I also think there's two books embedded in it, because if you just read the book on its face value with this kind of pre-Victorian morality of you know, domesticity and virtue tied to femininity and all of these, you know, these kind of tidy bows put on each chapter, then I think you miss what's really roiling underneath. And if you read it that way, of course, Camille Paglia is completely right. It is something that would be a horror show if that is all you're seeing. But the way I look at it is, if you can take the ending of the book where she felt she must marry Joe off to someone because that's what the readers demanded, and she made this economic decision that that's what she would do because she had to sell books, then if you read everything through the lens of, well, she had to make it all kind of tidy for the time, then if you just take away the tidiness, what's left is a whole bunch of ambition and mess and anger and lust and craziness and things that don't fit neatly into any box. And so what I wanted to do was not update the text. The text doesn't need updating. I wanted to take away the constraints of the time in some ways, because that's what was interesting to me. And even in those constraints, Louisa really did do her best to try to imagine what would an egalitarian marriage look like? What would something that was not essentially indentured servitude be as a marriage? And I feel that, you know, Gloria Steinem being one of them, but whether Simone de Beauvoir or Patti Smith or Elena Ferrante or J.K. Rowling, there's a long list of women for whom this book meant very specific freedom and ambition. And what I wanted to do was make a film that was in the tradition of why that inspired them. Because there's got to be a reason more than she got married to Professor Bear.
Greta, so good to see you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you. That was really fun.
Greta Gerwig is the writer and director of Little Women. It arrives in theaters on December 25th. It's the Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Entertainment journalist Whitney Friedlander wrote a piece published in the LA Times this week asking what happens when a stereotype becomes an archetype. She was talking about how Jewish women have been depicted on TV through the years, up to and including on the Emmy-winning Amazon series, The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
It's almost become expected that if you're going to have a character who's Jewish, that person has to embody a certain quality. They have to have certain identifying characteristics so that everyone knows they're Jewish. And that actually is very limiting because, of course, there are all kinds of different kinds of Jewish people. We're not all white. We're not all from New York. So while I do see myself in a lot of these characters, and I do see coding in a lot of characters that may not be identified as Jewish to kind of signal they're Jewish, like one of the sources in the article mentions some of the characters on Friends, the idea of diversity and the idea of broadening the playing field a little bit, I hope will come as we have a gazillion more shows on TV. And I think Batwoman, which really struck me as interesting about Batwoman, is that she just happens to be Jewish and they're not making it like a thing about it. And that's the story they want to tell. And that's great that they want to tell the story just the way that it's great that Maisel wants to tell a story in that certain way. But it's interesting to me that they're not pointing arrows at it the way that a lot of other shows do or have done in the past.
How would you characterize the different responses from Jewish viewers to Mrs. Maisel?
So a lot of people, either one, love the show. Like, there's a scene in the third season, which just premiered a few weeks ago, where there's a birth ceremony on screen, which is the Jewish ceremony of welcoming a baby boy into the Jewish faith.
Moshe, bris first, food after.
I know.
I don't want you upsetting the rabbi.
The rabbi's happy enough I'm wearing pants. Wearing pants, rabbi!
And people might have appreciated seeing that kind of authenticity to a show. On the other hand, there's people who feel like it's pulling too much into stereotypes, where it's not helping the anti-Semitism views in the country that Jews are already obsessed with money, or we're spendthrifts, or we're bossy, or we get whatever we want. You know, they don't like that. There are other shows like Crazy Ex-Girlfriend or Broad City, both of which ended this spring, and both of which are great shows about characters who happen to be younger Jewish women in their 20s and 30s, one of my favorite things that Crazy Ex-Girlfriend ever did was they did this, and I hate to use this term, but they used it, Jap rap battle, which is Jap stands for Jewish American Princess.
That means disgrace. I'm translating for the goys. Our lifelines have been parallel like corduroys, but now we'll see whose bars will prevail in this beef of two hard as nails. She brews from Scarsdale. We've got a
conflict. And that rap talks about the pressures of being a Jewish woman. But it's not the only thing you have to know about those characters. You can watch that show and not think, oh, it's a Jewish show.
The other thing that Crazy Ex-Girlfriend does that I think is worth pointing out is that it's challenging the stereotypes that pop culture has promulgated.
Correct. I talked to the showrunner for this story, and she was talking about that, you know, being a Jewish woman in America has baggage. I mean, everyone has baggage for some degree. But I relate to that because I am a Jewish woman. I understand what she's saying. Like, there is a certain stigma that regardless of whether we have it, it's expected of us. And a lot of that comes from the portrayals of Jewish women in television and movies.
I think it's fair to say that part of the problem that Hollywood has had in depicting women, people of color, underrepresented groups, people with disabilities, is there are not a lot of people like that making creative decisions.
Right.
Newsflash, there are a fair number of people who are Jewish who are making creative decisions in Hollywood. So how has the industry failed when there are people who know these stories and yet are still resorting to stereotypes?
Yeah, it's super interesting that like the Jewish women stereotype that has taken over television culture, you know, was usually put there by Jewish men. I do think that we as a culture need to do better. I think television and film in general need to think broader. When you say Jewish character in a character breakdown, they need to think about the idea that this character doesn't have to have all these traits that you now associate with being a Jewish character, a Jewish woman. You know, Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, I've been told, is meant to be a love letter to the Jewish people, and I do not doubt it is. And I am interested to see how people respond to it now that it's been greenlighted for a fourth season.
We're talking about Jewish women in television with Whitney Friedlander. I want to ask you about a couple other series. I want to ask you about Transparent, where some of the characters in Transparent are Jewish. And there are moments in the series, especially as it was wrapping up, that really kind of delved into what they believed and about faith and ceremony. What's your take on how Transparent dealt with Judaism and Jewishness?
I think it's really interesting, especially now in this current political climate, to have characters who explore their religion in any way. Just Always separated Judaism from Jewishness in a way that I thought was really great. Transparent had lots of conversations about trauma and the idea that trauma can be passed down through generations because of previous events.
We Jews got a painful history that we choose to convey in minor keys, and we say never to forget the pain.
Which is something that's very big in the Jewish culture and is obviously big in lots of cultures that have been stigmatized and victimized. But to kind of break it down, how all of these characters could feel this and like kind of in their DNA was really, really interesting and speaks to a broader sense of the understanding of modern-day Judaism, I think.
Whitney Friedlander is a freelance entertainment journalist. You can read her piece, Being a Jewish Woman Comes with Baggage. What you see on TV just scratches the surface, on the LA Times website. Whitney, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Great. Well, happy Hanukkah. Rap
battle. Coming up after a short break, screenwriter Anthony McCarten has channeled Winston Churchill and Freddie Mercury. In The Two Popes, he does the same with Popes Benedict and Francis. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The more you try to describe the two popes, the more people might start to lose interest. Yes, it's about two popes. And yes, they spend most of the movie talking, or walking and talking, or sitting and talking. But the movie about imagined conversations between Pope Benedict and Pope Francis is remarkably compelling, even for a lifetime Episcopalian like me. The Two Popes stars Anthony Hopkins as the conservative Pope Benedict and Jonathan Pryce as the progressive Pope Francis.
Come and see it if you're a Roman Catholic. You can come and see it if you're an agnostic. And you will get something from it that will suit your personal view and hopefully will inspire and enhance your personal view of life.
We're going to hear more from Jonathan Pryce about playing Pope Francis and working with Hopkins in a few minutes, but let's start with the two-pope screenwriter, Anthony McCartan.
What I'm doing is a conceit, for sure. It's a confection. But everything they're saying is based on the recorded positions and statements of these two characters. And what I'm doing is putting them in the same room and turning them into dialogue.
His other movies include Bohemian Rhapsody and The Darkest Hour. For this movie, he dreams up a conversation between the two popes that never actually happened. Pope Benedict is thinking about stepping down, and the man who's going to become Pope Francis isn't sure he wants to succeed him.
Your style and your methods are entirely different to mine. I don't agree with any of most of the things you say, think, or do, but for some strange reason, now I can see a necessity for Bergoglio. But I can't do this without knowing that there is at least a possibility that you might be chosen.
No. It could never be me.
All right. We are at an impasse.
It seems like every time I see you, we're talking about what you've made up and what is real.
Yeah.
Which I guess is your, there's the Pixar brand and there's the Anthony McCartan brand.
Yeah. And my answers always vary, and I'd love to settle on one answer. But it's just, it's a sort of conundrum. You're dealing with history, and people therefore think everything should be literal and sourced. But history is incomplete, and it's like a road washed out at intervals. And you have to fill in the gaps. We don't know what was said in a certain room on a certain day, and so that's where the invention and speculation comes in. My last outing, well, before last, was writing, you know, dialogue for Winston Churchill.
We need an army, General Tell Brigadier Nicholson. The Germans must not reach the sea, not before we get our boys off of that bloody beach.
I've written for Stephen Hawking.
What if I reverse the process all the way back to see what happened at the beginning of time itself?
These are geniuses. I am not on my best day, even a quarter of a genius. So how do I get away with it? I do as much research as I can. It's a kind of ventriloquism. You work out what their vocabulary is. You work out what their ideas are. And you kind of intellectually, it's like putting up bumpers in a bowling alley.
So you don't roll a gutter ball.
So you don't roll a gutter ball. Yeah. And you just go, oh, no way would Churchill have said that. Or would Freddie Mercury have said that.
I think it's beautiful.
It's almost perfect.
Almost.
Yes, give it more rock and roll.
Well, I'm always up for that, Fred.
Put your body into it.
At a certain point, you know, in my career, I've just thought, well, what the hell? You know, someone's got to do it. I'll have a shot at it.
There has been a lot that Pope Francis has shared through his priesthood when he was a parish priest, Jorge Bergoglio in Argentina, when he was a cardinal, about the way he saw the world, the way he saw the church in the world, and the way he saw the Vatican and the Pope in the world. How much was known about what Benedict was thinking and talking about beyond what he was presenting to the public?
You mean his own evolution as a,
correct,
because, as a theologian? Well, they're both very, very different characters. So what, you know, you've got the football-loving, crowd-friendly Francis, and you've got the very bookish German Benedict, a.k.a. Cardinal Ratzinger. We know a lot about Ratzinger because his rise to well, let's call it power or prominence, was very swift. His intellect became valued by the church very quickly, and he rose swiftly through the ranks. After being Archbishop in Munich, he was moved to the Vatican and made virtually the watchdog of dogma. And he said, it's essential in this world that we have one eternal truth, one unchanging eternal truth, the axis mundi. Change is therefore a very dangerous thing. The sexual revolution and the permissiveness of the 1960s truly shocked him. And it shocked him into a period of conservatism which he never departed from.
And I think it's fair to say Pope Francis followed a different interpretation of Scripture and of the church. And he saw the church as something that should not exclude but welcome, a church that play an active role in the planet and its health. And how did those ideas percolate within him? Because he's becoming a priest at a time when, primarily in Central America, there's a whole evolution of liberation theology where Catholic priests and nuns are talking about how Jesus wanted to liberate people rather than enslave them. How much was he influenced by what was happening in liberation theology versus what was happening in the real world in Argentina and other places where there was military dictatorships?
Well, I think his primary ministry, and it hasn't changed, has been to serve the poor. And this is this comes from the Jesuit tradition, and that was his primary mission. He had various things that challenged that, and partly it was that he was very suspicious of Marxism, and he saw that as another form of oppression. So liberation philosophy, theology, as it was practiced in Argentina when he was coming up, started to take on a Marxist tinge, and he started to take a stand against that. And this sort of harkens in a period in his life during the Dirty War in Argentina, which saw thousands and thousands disappeared and so forth. And at that time, he was head of the Jesuits, and he was tasked with keeping the priests alive because priests were being shot in the streets, being assumed as being Marxist. And so he detached from that. And his role during that period we explore in the movie, because it is a period which saw him undertake some actions and support some initiatives that he later very much regretted.
Anthony McCartan is the screenwriter of The Two Popes. It stars Jonathan Pryce as Pope Francis. I met with Pryce after the film premiered at the Telluride Film Festival over Labor Day weekend.
When I was first asked to play Pope Francis, I thought, oh no, this isn't a good idea, because the day he'd become Pope, the internet was full of images of me next to him, and the likeness was being brought out into the public eye, and even one of my sons sent me a text saying, Dad, are you the Pope? So it seemed a bit easy to actually come to play him. It seemed a bit of, am I just being employed because I look a bit like him? But this head of the church is someone that politically and socially I can fully embrace and endorse.
You made some remarks in introducing the film that I thought were really interesting, and they were reflected in something that Fernando Marias, the director of the film, shot. And that is that there's a conversation between your Pope, Pope Francis, and Anthony Hopkins' Pope, Pope Benedict, about walls, and about walls that separate the Vatican from the people of Rome, and walls that separate nations, and walls that separate the poor from the rich. And you talked about why that was important to you.
I think the end, the final images sum up what the film is about. It's about the kind of progressive attitude that Francis had, when he went into the Vatican, because he's met a lot of opposition there for his reforms. But what he ultimately represents, I think, is it's inspirational that you should think not of yourself, but you should think about breaking down the walls, the barriers. And, well, in this instance, it's about welcoming refugees and opening your arms and embracing that situation.
I want to ask you about working with Anthony Hopkins, because there are moments that feel as if they could be theater.
Your authority comes from the fact that you will suffer and die in the job. A martyr to justice and truth. For this, all people come. Forgive me, but...
But?
Christ did not come down from the cross.
Ah, God always grants you the right words.
Oh, no, no. A pope must go on forever, be the personification of the crucified Christ.
When Francis first approaches Benedict, he comes there to ostensibly to resign. He wants to leave the church. And he is fully respectful of whatever he thinks of Benedict. He is the pope. And there's a sense of awe when he walks into the Sistine Chapel, and there's something about the presence of Benedict. And I had that as an actor, because, you know, as a young actor, I've followed Anthony Hopkins' career. And I, Yeah, I was nervous of meeting him and nervous of working with him. And there was that sense of awe and wonder about this particular man, this fellow Welshman. And then the other side of it is that Tony and I just got on really, really well. And we made each other laugh. There was intense rivalry between the two of us because the call sheet, which lists the actors' names and the order of seniority on the of the cast, and I was number one, and number two was Tony Hopkins. And he was constantly ribbing me for being number one. He kept moving the number on my trailer to his and had huge signs made for his trailer, trying to boost his importance. And we email each other quite often, and he still emails me, "Good morning, number one," from, he manages to put in "Sir," from "Sir, number two." Just let me know.
Jonathan, great to see you. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
You can find The Two Popes in limited release in theaters. It's also on Netflix.
I'm John Horn, and you're listening to The Frame Weekend. There's an exhibit up now by an LA photographer named Thomas Kiefer, and it tries to humanize people detained at the U.S.-Mexico border through the ordinary objects that were seized from them. His photos are currently on display at the Skirball Center in West L.A. in a show titled El Sueño Americano, The American Dream. Frame contributor Marcos Najara has our story.
Two small chairs and two pairs of headphones are stationed in a corner of the gallery. When you slip on the headphones, out comes Gwen Stefani. And even a little Marvin Gaye. All things and what they lose. And Maya. Are you gonna tell me? While you're listening to the jams, you see a large framed photograph showing rows and rows of CDs on a hot pink background. From salsa to soul, this music belonged to a woman named Cynthia Gallegos Lucas. Photographer Tom Kiefer found her trash collection in southern Arizona. He took a picture of the set and shares it now in his El Sueño Americano show. As for Cynthia, we don't really know. Several years ago, Tom Kiefer ran an antique shop in LA's Silver Lake neighborhood. The likes of Cher and Bette Midler were known to pop in now and again. But when times got tough, he moved to the small border town of Ajo, Arizona. Kiefer took a job as a custodian, cleaning the local U.S. Border Patrol station. It wasn't long before he noticed a troubling trend.
It was summer of 2007 that all this food, perfectly good canned food, was just being thrown away, and it bothered me deeply.
That food belonged to people like Cynthia Gallegos Lucas, trying to make their way across the dangerous Sonoran Desert border. When federal agents capture someone, most, if not all, of their personal belongings, including food, water, clothes, cash, condoms and toys, even fortune cookie papers, are trashed. But Tom Kiefer says it wasn't always that way in Ajo.
When I started working at the station, one of my first memories was of the agents collecting the food and taking it to our local food bank. And then there was a change of leadership. And when the head chief found out what was going on with the food, he put an immediate halt to that. I mean, there are people out there to arrest.
And that is how it all started.
I couldn't take it anymore. And so I went to one of the supervisors, and I said, "Hey, can I bring this food to the food bank?" And his exact words to me were, "Bless you."
But when Kiefer would sift through the trash bins to pull out the food, he started finding lots more than canned tuna.
Oh my God, there's a Bible here. There's a rosary. There's a family photograph. It just instinctively struck me as, this is not right. So whenever I would see something like that, I would just put it in with the box where I put the food.
He'd smuggle out larger, bulkier items like backpacks and blankets in big trash bags.
Shoes, the jeans, anything that was considered non-essential or potentially lethal was taken away, confiscated, and then just thrown in the trash.
I met up with Kiefer recently in Phoenix to learn more about his work. We're at a frame shop where he's getting some prints finished for upcoming shows and for clients like Chapman University in Orange County. Kiefer had not initially planned on taking pictures of the personal treasures from the trash, but here in Phoenix, he brainstormed with fellow artists and shared some test shots.
I have to admit, I was one of the skeptical people. I thought, they're a little too designy.
Liz Allen is head curator at Northlight Gallery in Phoenix.
But I knew, because I've seen this happen before, you see early work of someone and you realize, oh, this is going somewhere.
Eventually, Allen featured Kiefer's growing body of work at Northlight. That show caught the eye of LA's Skirball Center, and the rest is history. But far away from the pristine halls of high-end galleries is the harsher reality of the people who owned the objects in Kiefer's pictures. Right before I met the photographer in Phoenix, I went to a gathering where people were writing Christmas cards for migrant families who were incarcerated at immigration detention centers here in the Phoenix area.
The least we can do is send them a little card and let them know that at least we're still thinking about them.
Esther Duran Lum is with a refugee aid group called Uncaged and Reunite Families. She works directly with the people that most of us can only imagine when we look at Tom Kiefer's pictures. I showed her some of his photos, including one of a single eyelash curler.
It's just a little something to say, you know what? I still care about myself. I care how I look. I haven't lost my identity.
Duran Lum was also struck by the portrait of dozens of confiscated cell phones. She says the picture tells only part of the story of someone seeking asylum, so she fills in the rest.
When the court would send them a message to their cell phone that, you know, their court date was such and such, they're never going to get it. They have no phone. They have nothing. So they miss it, and then they say, okay, you're not eligible.
Esther Duran Lum suggests I take Tom Kiefer to visit the Refugee Welcome Center near the Phoenix airport before he heads back to Ajo.
Our team will guide him through the ropa room.
You're saying ropa, like clothes?
Ropa, like clothes, yes.
We quickly realize Kiefer connects with people when they're stripped of their belongings. Here, new versions of those items are restored. That is, at least for those lucky enough to make it this far.
I keep on discovering things. I realize now, oh my God, that pair of coveralls, someone who worked as a mechanic or, I mean, el sueño americano.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
Thomas Kiefer's exhibition is at the Skirball Center through March 8th. Coming up, the director and cinematographer for the new film, 1917. Stay with us. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. Around this time every year, The Blacklist comes out.
The Blacklist is a survey of Hollywood's most liked unproduced screenplays. Every year in December, end of November, we survey, in this case, it was just over 250 folks, about their 10 favorite scripts of the year. We combine the information and make it available to the public.
The Blacklist was started in 2005 by Franklin Leonard. He doesn't vote on the scripts. That's done by some 250 Hollywood executives.
They're the executives at the major film financiers and production companies. So the folks who are actually functioning as the gatekeepers in the industry. But they are disproportionately white, disproportionately male, disproportionately upper middle class, disproportionately straight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that if you look at the annual lists over the course of the last 15 years, this being our 15th year, you'll see that background reflected. What's fascinating about that is that as Hollywood has begun to open up, and an emphasis on begun there, you're seeing a lot of different kinds of writers and a lot of different kinds of stories being included. We are seeing the beginnings of an evolution in Hollywood, accepting that the conventional wisdom that they've always accepted about what works and what doesn't, and who has talent and who doesn't, is more convention than wisdom.
So one of the scripts that was on last year's list that has just come out in theaters is Queen and Slim, which is a highly political film. It's described by its makers, Melina Matsoukas and Lena Waithe, as a form of protest art. Do you start seeing in this year's list screenwriters wrestling with issues that are personal, societal, political? And does that seem to be happening more than maybe in years past?
I don't know that I would say that it's happening more than in years past. I mean, I take the position, generally speaking, that sort of all art is political in one way or another. I mean, even the assertion that, art is not political is sort of fundamentally political. So I think that in many ways, telling a story that you hope to tell to ideally tens of millions of people is a fundamentally political act, because that story will, if well executed, will make tens of millions of people see the world a little bit differently than they did before they heard it. And, you know, it may be unquantifiable, the effect, but it's in aggregate undeniable.
It was clear to me in reading some of the log lines for some of the top vote getters that a lot of screenwriters are wrestling with technology and how it can be used for better or worse, or how it can take a conventional story and turn it upside down through time travel, through some sort of device. Is that something kind of thematically you're starting to see?
It's a very astute observation, and we're seeing it over the last couple of years. This year, there was definitely an overabundance of time travel or time manipulation scripts. I also think that technology provides a really easy way to distort our reality in such a way that you can investigate some feature of our actual day-to-day reality. So whether it's I'm the last person on Earth and I turn the corner and run into an ex-girlfriend and then have to reckon with that, as the logline of the number one script on this year's list, Move On by Ken Kobayashi, goes, that's a way to investigate the nature of relationships with one very simple premise that's a shift either technologically or sort of imagination-wise to the lives that we live day to day.
We're talking with Franklin Leonard about The Blacklist. So I want to ask you about one script that probably is going to get some attention. It's a fictionalized Barron Trump story called Barron, A Tale of Love, Loss, and Legacy by Nicholas Curcio.
Nicholas Curcio, yeah. It is part of a long tradition of sort of people taking imagined versions of public figures and showing, hey, I can tell a good story. And look, I've read it. I think that it is a rather adorable coming-of-age story about a smart, empathetic, patriotic young man who believes that his father running for president is going to be an obstacle to his social life and potentially to the progress of the free world, and goes about trying to make sure that that doesn't happen. Certainly, there's rational discomfort about someone writing a script about the president's minor child. But I don't have any children, but I do have four nieces. If someone is going to write a script about them, I hope that they would portray them as smart, empathetic, patriotic, and genuinely a lovely human and heroic human being, as this script attempts to paint Barron Trump.
Franklin Leonard is the founder and CEO of The Blacklist. The 2019 Blacklist is out now. Franklin, thanks for coming. Always great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. The upcoming film 1917 is an ambitious World War I drama co-written and directed by Sam Mendes. He made the Oscar-winning American Beauty. To pull off his idea for how to shoot it, he turned to famed cinematographer Roger Deakins. For 1917, Deakins and Mendes set out to do something really difficult, which was film the movie as if it's all one continuous shot. Mendes has a background in theater, which made shooting 1917 as one shot a little bit easier.
I feel like I use a lot of my theater muscles when it came to staging individual scenes, for example, particularly in compressed spaces in the trenches and in dugouts and rooms and what have you. So there are similarities. The difference is, however, that the landscape is constantly moving and the camera is constantly moving.
Your orders are to get to the second at Kwasi Wood, 1 mile southeast of the town of Bakust. Deliver this to Colonel Mackenzie. It is a direct order to call off tomorrow morning's attack. If you don't, it will be a massacre.
It's about two people most of the time in a vast landscape, and trying to do justice not only to their emotional journey, but to the huge panorama of destruction that they're moving through, and trying to let the movie breathe in and breathe out, whereas on stage, you're kind of just always breathing in.
When you look at playback, Roger, and you're checking to see if a shot works,
How do you make sure that the shot itself works, that you're getting what you need cinematically, and that you're getting performance? And how do you score a certain scene to make sure that both are at the level that you're happy with?
I mean, I don't usually on a film watch playback much. I mean, I was watching playback on this quite a bit. But it was very different because the shots were worked out very well in advance. The takes we were looking back at were small things to finesse, maybe with the camera or something we might discuss about the relationship of the actors to the camera, if the actors were too lined up or something simple like
but
that.
But interestingly, when we've got it, we almost never would watch playback. We just came out of our respective horse boxes, which were often miles away from where the action ended up, because these people were, the lads were traveling half a mile in one shot, you know. And we would just look at each other and say, yeah, that's it.
Martha! It's Martha!
We should put him out of his misery.
No, get him some water. He needs water.
I remember talking to the producer, Mark Abraham, who made Children of Men. And there were a lot of long takes in that film. And he would tell me about calling the studio, same studio, Universal, and they'd say, what do you got for us today? And he's like, we don't have anything. We didn't get a shot. So when you have a tough day, what are the results? And are there some days, for whatever reason, weather or something else, where you don't get a shot, but you know that you're moving forward?
Yes, there were lots of days we didn't get a shot. But the great stroke of genius was that Roger had the courage early on to say, listen, if we're not in cloud, we aren't going to be able to shoot.
I think that was more suicidal and genius, actually. But
meaning sunlight was your worst enemy, because then you can't match?
The sun comes out once in the film, and that's the last shot of the film where I wanted it to come out.
He arranged it. It cost him a lot of money. But we told the studio in the first production meeting, and to their immense credit, they did go a bit pale, but they didn't freak out. And they trusted us that we were going to get it in the end. And we were lucky with the weather. Having said that, we also prepped the hell out of it for months and months and months. And we worked very, very hard. And there were days which were extremely frustrating. But they were generally forgotten immediately, because you get the shot and then you move on and you're so thrilled and exhilarated to have got it.
We're talking with Sam Mendes and Roger Deakins about their film 1917. I saw the film last night, and I was sitting next to a woman who, for the majority of the film, was in a fetal position, cowering.
Oh, God.
But the fact that this woman was viscerally fearful, as if she was in a horror movie, to me kind of spoke to the way I imagine you hope the film works.
The key is that you don't want to feel as an audience manipulated. So, and that is tricky, because you are aware that this is a real historic event and that there's a certain amount of respect that needs to be paid for the people who live through it. And it's not an entertainment. But at the same time, you want people to fear what the characters are fearing. And terror and adrenaline is exactly what they live through. Long periods of boredom and waiting, and then short bursts of utter terror.
Come on! I can't see! I can't see! Stop! 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 It's a mine shaft! But we have to jump!
I think that the one shot helps with that, because I think you feel in a weird way pulled in, claustrophobic, that you know, you begin to feel, even if you don't intellectually understand it, you begin to feel there is no way out.
Roger, let me ask you this last question. There have been a lot of films about World War II, and I think part of what your film gets at is that thousands of people died over hundreds of yards, that the carnage in relation to the geography was incalculable. And if people start thinking about what happened during World War I, what might you hope they appreciate about this war that maybe they didn't fully understand now?
I grew up in south of England in Devon, and all the little villages and towns in Devon have a monument in there at the center on the village green. And I know one in particular. It's got 25 names on it. It's got 6 names, all the surnames the same. It's got another 5, all the surnames the same. All those kids came from the same family. This is a little rural village in Devon, and that's all over the country. And it's so sad that those sacrifices are forgotten. I'm sorry, I'm getting a bit emotional, but I was brought up seeing that, and I always wondered what happened. And I've been so interested in studying both the wars because of that. I think this film, if it brings back some memory and some interest in it again, but I got to say, if we showed what was really in some of the photographs that we saw in references, there wouldn't be anybody in the audience after 5 minutes. I mean, it was horrendous.
Sam and Roger, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Sam Mendes is the co-writer and director of 1917. Roger Deakins is the film cinematographer. The film is in theaters on December 25th. And that'll do it for this week. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by Herb, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Itzi Quintanilla. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. The Frame's theme music, which you're hearing now, is by Taylor McFerrin, and our senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn at the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We're back here Monday for the daily version of The Frame. We'll see you then. Thank you.